Well, it's a fine audience, and I appreciate your being here and appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I'm struggling with voice tonight, so I'll try to speak up enough that you can hear me. I just had about an hour wonderful dinner, but I talked the whole time. So we'll have to see how much we have left. But it's great to have you. I'm going to be talking this evening about, I don't think my screen is working up here. Is there a way to turn it on? Well, anyhow, I'm going to be talking about finding our way through the troubles of life. I've tried to select some lessons that would be useful for young people as well as for older people. Good. Thanks. And this is my lesson about from the book of Ecclesiastes, which deals with just the most fundamental question that all of us face, and that is, what are we doing here? And what's the significance of life? And people try a lot of different things. In the first chapter, in verses 2 and 3, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? That word vanity, which is used over and over in the book of Ecclesiastes, is the word hebel. And it's really the word for able. And he says that what happens with Abel is he dies. First human being to die. And so his death raises the question of our mortality. And that we're born and we die. And what does it mean? What's the significance of our life? And the older you get, the more you have to ponder that question. But you young people have to confront that same question. What is the meaning of my life? And how can I find some significant way to live all the years of my life? The book of Ecclesiastes actually suggests four different ways that we can go about trying to figure out what life means and consequently how we ought to behave ourselves. The first question, the first way that he suggests in the book of Ecclesiastes to answer the question, what profit does man have for all his labor under the sun? And what is the meaning of life is, beginning in verse 16, I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I'm come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that were before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know knowledge, wisdom, and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. So he says one way we can go about trying to find meaning for our existence in being here is we can search for wisdom. Surely if there's any way to find out what the best way to live your life is, it is to use our minds and say, I will become wise and learn more than all they that were before me. He said, I even gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I'll tell you a quick little story about that. I've had a lot of conversations like this in my life, sitting in faculty meetings and with faculty friends. And in the first place I taught, there was one fellow that I liked a lot, but he was strange. And we were sitting talking about what life means one day, and he said to me, he said, Ed, he said, I believe that the only people who understand life are crazy people. And that's what this passage says. It says, I considered everything. I considered all the scholars, all of the wisdom that people have, and I even looked at it through the lens of a crazy person. And actually, if you knew this guy, he probably had done that. So, but he said, in all of this, it's just vanity and vexation of my of heart. Let's read a few more verses, verse 16 through 18. I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I'm come to greater wisdom, and more than all they that were before me in Jerusalem. And my heart came to know wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and knowledge, and even madness. I saw this cartoon years ago in the newspaper, and it always brings this point to my mind of how do you figure out what life means, when why I'm here, the significance of living. And the story in this cartoon reminded me of a story that one of my professors told me one day of a student who came in and said, he came in asking me, he said, well, what in a philosophy class, what is the meaning of life? How do I figure out what life is? And he said, I told him that, you know, I can't answer that. I don't know how to find an answer to that. He said, but I'll tell you, the greatest philosopher that I've ever known was my professor in Germany. And if anybody knows, he probably can give you an answer to what is the meaning of life. So this young man supposedly sold all of his wealth and made a trip to Germany and went to this professor, and he said, what is the meaning of life? And the professor said, I don't know the answer to that. I'm just a philosophy teacher. I don't know that meaning of life. But he said, I'll tell you, if anybody knows, I one time met a very wise guru in India who is up on a mountain in the Himalaya Mountains. And he's thought about this all of his life, and he may know. So he borrowed the money and went to India, and climbed up the mountain, found the guru and said to him, what is life? And the guru said, life is a river. And the guy said, wait a minute. You mean I spent all my money and borrowed everything I could get to come over here and ask you what is life, and you tell me life is a river? And the guru said, you mean life is not a river? So, what I want to tell you is, if you're asking that question, how do I find meaning for my life? You won't find anybody that's smart enough to answer that. Nobody knows the answer. And so, he said, it's not through wisdom. If you somehow think you're going to go to college and study somewhere and you'll figure out what life is all about, you're mistaken in that. That's futility. Second way, he says, we can find meaning in life is through getting things, through materialism. What life's purpose is about having a lot of fun and enjoying yourself, right? In the second chapter, beginning in verse 3, he said, I said in mine heart, go to now, I'll prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is madness, and mirth, what doeth it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was the good for the sons of men, which they should do all the, under heaven all the days of their life. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. So a second answer that he's given, and this is probably the answer that most people give today, that what life is about is just getting as much out of it as you can. Just enjoying yourself and enjoy mirth. Let's just go out and have parties and whoop it up. And surely that's what life is all about. I'll tell you, I've sat in quite a few faculty meetings when somebody would come, one of the people would come up to me and say, boy, you ought to have been with us this weekend. We all went out and got dead drunk and had a big party, and did we have fun? And they all looked like they were about to bleed to death from their eyes, you know, and their heads about to bust. And so I always tried to pound on the table to see if I could help that a little. That wasn't fun. That life is not fun if what you're doing is just trying to find pleasure in the things that you can do. What you'll find is that is futility and that there's no profit under the sun. But actually, there is a higher suggestion about what life is about. But what he says beginning in chapter 2 and verse 4, that what he thought life probably was about was to just do as great a things as you could do and accomplish as much as you could accomplish. I made me great works, and I built me houses, I planted me vineyards, and I made gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them and all kinds of fruits. And verse 9 beginning, he says, so I was great and increased more than all they that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I'd labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. If you define your life as just look what things I've accomplished, most of us will not have accomplished what Solomon has. But he said, I improved the livestock and I brought new fruits and vegetation, and I was built great buildings, and I was great. Now, most of us won't have a list like that. But if when you come to the end of your life, and you look back on it, as I'm kind of doing now, and you say, well, how do I sum up what life was about? And if all you can say is, well, I taught this many classes, and I wrote this many books, and I've done a lot of things, if that's all it is, It's vanity and vexation of spirit. And by the way, he says, you know, you may accumulate a lot of things, but I'm not going to take the time to read all of that. But he says, when the time comes and you die, you'll leave it all behind. And you may leave it to some sorry son or daughter that's not worth anything anyhow. But if that defines you, if all that your life is about is accumulating things, then it's vanity and vexation of spirit. Now, there's a third way that he suggests in Ecclesiastes, and that is that the skeptic says in chapter 3, to everything there's a season and a time under for every purpose under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, A time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, and a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. And a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. What profiteth he that worketh under the sun, wherein he laboreth? Now that's kind of a 50s passage of what's known as existentialism. If you ask the question, what's life all about? The answer that he says, some people come to the conclusion, it's not about anything. We're just here. We live. We die. We're happy. We're sad. And one generation comes along and piles stones up in one place and builds a wall. The next generation comes and throws it away. You know, the Beatles made a song out of this, that it just one thing follows another, and it doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't have any meaning. And if that's true, if what we're experiencing tonight is that we're just animals that don't have anything to do with what happens, but we can think about it. You know, a dog's going to die, but as far as I know, a dog doesn't know he's going to die. But you know you're going to die. And if life is just an endless sequence of events in which you don't know what's going to happen, then in many ways, that's the worst thing, a worst possible answer to that question. So, again, he says that at the beginning of chapter 4, so I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun and the tears, behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter, and on the side of their oppressors there was power. Wherefore I praise the dead, which are already dead, more than the living, which are yet alive. Yea, better is both he than they, which hath not yet seen, which has not yet been, who hath not seen the evil works done in the sun. He said, if that's right, if life has no meaning, and you can't give an answer to the question of what's the significance of my being here, he said, that's the worst answer of all. And you'd be better off be dead than to be alive. And in fact, he said it'd be better to have never been born if you're just here and you go through the troubles and trials of life and death, then that is the saddest answer of all. But in the fifth chapter, at the beginning of the fifth chapter, he gives the answer, which is, I think, the answer that all of us ought to embrace this evening, and that it will indeed give meaning to your life. Keep thy foot when thou goest into the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God's own in heaven, and thou upon earth, therefore let thy words be few. When I was teaching at the University of Georgia, one of the fellows in the department, he was a very talented man, but he just talked all the time. In any conversation, he would chime in and give you the answer. One of my other friends described it one time. He said, I'll tell you Charlie's problem. He greets every question with an open mouth. And that was exactly right. That's what he did. And too often, that's what people do. You ask the question, what does life mean? And everybody starts talking. And what this passage says is, what you need to do is shut up and listen to God. Because you don't know and no man knows. And so he says, what we need to do is we need to be quiet. And if we ever find out what the meaning of life is, it'll be because we hear it from God and not from man. So if we reconcile ourselves to do that, and we'll end there in just a few minutes, it will have to be with this concept of what we need to do is be quiet and listen. And if we do that, then I think we can face life. We can face it at its worst, as he says in verse 8 of chapter 5. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in the province, marvel not at the matter, for he that's higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. You ever see anything happen in life that you don't like? Wait around till tomorrow night. Yeah, I see a lot of things I don't like. But there's not anything I can do about it. I've said years ago, back when the Cold War was going on, and sometimes it would seem things would really get tense, that on a couple of occasions there were confrontations, nuclear confrontations, between the United States and the Soviet Union, and it got pretty dicey. And I wondered, well, what can I do about this? And I thought one time, well, probably what I should do is, I was living in Birmingham at the time, I said, what I probably ought to do is just write a letter to the Kremlin and say, now, if you guys really get mad with each other, I wish you wouldn't shoot one of those at Birmingham because it would inconvenience me. So, but I decided, well, that probably wouldn't do any good. And I don't have any power to do that. You don't control the world when you grow up. But what this passage says is, okay, be quiet and listen to God. And if you see things you don't like, don't worry about it. He that's higher than the highest regardeth. And there's somebody higher than the president or the premier of the Soviet Union or anybody else. God sees and God knows. And whatever the difficulties that come along in life, I can say I know God knows about that. I'll tell you another thing about that. It helps you to face tragedy. Years ago, I think it was up here in North Alabama somewhere, I was in a meeting, and some of the people came up to me and said, there was a young woman there, said, did they tell you about their little girl? And I said, no, they didn't. And they told me the story of this young woman who had a young 4 or 5 year old child who had died. And they said, she said something when she got where she could say anything about it. She said, I don't want to understand it. All I can say is that heaven means more to me now than it ever could have meant before. So all of us face tragedy. You'll have hard things happen in your life. We just had a son die. Was very beloved. But I find myself waking up every day thinking, well, I wonder what Robert's doing. You'll have to live with tragedy as a Christian. But above all, a Christian can deal with life at its worst and with life at its best. In chapter 2, there's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hither and to more than I? I'll tell you, if you put your trust in God and say, I'm going to put my life in God's hands. You know, there's nothing wrong with having things. There's nothing wrong with being successful. You need to enjoy it. Chapter 5, verse 18, behold, that which I've seen, it's good and comely for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor which he taketh unto the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion, to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Now, if you have a good life, be thankful for it. You don't have to regret that. God wants us to prosper and enjoy life. You don't live for those things, but God is perfectly attuned to the fact that they can be a blessing to us if we use them correctly. But finally, the point of the book of Ecclesiastes is we want something more. We yearn for deeper for meaning. In the third chapter, verse 11, that's a really important verse, in which he says he has made everything beautiful in his time, and also he has set the world in their heart. God has put in all of us this understanding that there is more and that we want to know why we have to go through these things and what God would have us to do. And so that leads us to the final exhortation, which I'm going to talk some more about in our subsequent lessons. To the conclusion of the book, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. I will tell you what will give meaning to your life. Is fear God. One time someone said to me, well, we shouldn't live in fear, should we? So I decided I'd look fear up and see how many times it's used. It's used about 110 times. And every time it's translated more or less the same, translated fear. So I'll tell you what it means, I believe, to fear God. I think it means you fear him. That is, you have to recognize who God is, who I am and who God is, and we don't come to him casually or in a trivial set of mind, but we come to him in his fear of who he is and his grandeur and keep his commandments. Now, I'm going to talk with you tomorrow night about the significance of what we should do. You should listen and then keep his commandments. Being a Christian is not complicated. It's just listening to God and saying, I have no idea what I should be doing. Hear what he says and do it. For this is the whole judgment, the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his, for God shall bring every work into judgment whether with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Living our lives is a matter of bringing ourselves into submission to God, saying, I have no answers to what it means or what I should do. The only answer is to listen to him, see what he says, and then go and do what he says. Not complicated. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to travel anywhere to learn that. You just need to submit yourself to that. If you're in the audience this evening and you never have obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, we'd urge you to come. It'll fill your life with meaning. And it will relieve the sting of death that all of us face so that we can depart with a sense of accomplishment and peace, knowing if we fear God, keep his commandments, that we fulfill the whole duty of man, and that we will meet them again on the other side. If you're here and you never have become a Christian, accepted Jesus Christ as our Savior, and repented of your sins, been baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of your sins to become a child of God, you can come to the end of your life with a great sense of accomplishment and meaning if we fear God and keep his commandments. If you're here and subject to the invitation would come, we invite you while we stand and sing.